accession number 2008, real 6.
Dennis Rybak, real 6.
Yeah, well, after that, we moved on. I suppose we moved on up further north into Holland, or the whole part of Belgium. We got so far forward, I don't know how it come about. We got so far forward, we got cut off of the echelon near a forest. That must be somewhere around Antwerp, mate.
During that attack at St. Leonard's, you mentioned the Germans not liking the flamethrowers.
Yeah.
Do you think as a weapon that it was more a weapon of fear?
Fear, yeah. Oh, yeah. But, I mean, if you got caught in a pillbox, mate, you was dead, because that bounced round that like a rubber ball, like it'd go through the slits and bounce round and round it.
Did you ever see any of the damage that had been done by them?
No, I didn't, honestly speaking, I never. The only thing, tank that ever I looked at, I wouldn't go near them what were knocked out, because I was scared enough myself.
So you've moved
on? The only tank I saw was when a Typhoon had knocked out. That was a Jerry Mark IV. And they rocketed, and we saw it happen. A Churchill went over the bridge of the 141 RAC, I think it was, Royal Army Corps, and got knocked out. And the crew bailed out, and we was waiting to go across this bridge. The crew bailed out and come back over underneath a small stream and got away. So they done more and called up the tactical air force. And the Typhoon come up, and we saw him go out, we saw him dive down, heard the explosion. And everything started off again. We started going over this bridge. Well, as a matter of fact, we stopped not far from where the Jerry tank was, and we saw this thing blown to bits. Crew and all. Yeah, I mean, that's the way it was. The Typhoons really saved us a lot.
Was that a matter of fear when you were in tanks that you were going to be knocked out?
Well, no, you never thought about it at the time, but you was too busy, and you know what I mean. You've got to keep your wits about you. I mean, this is not a thing. You're keyed up. I suppose you're keyed up like you are or anything like that. You're keyed up, but you've got to know your job. I mean, ain't no good thinking too much about that when you've got guns to service. And I mean, you've got to keep in communication with all the others. And, you know, at times when you're standing still, I suppose it's a bit nerve-wracking, but that's a fear. I don't know how you put it. You seem to overcome fear. I don't overcome it, but you hold it back. I suppose everybody felt, I don't know whether everybody felt the same or not, but I've certainly been frightened many a time in my life. And yet, when anything's happened, I've thought, when I nearly had it, when the bomb dropped near me and the mortars, and I just thought I was lucky. I thought I was never going to be killed, you know. I mean, that's the way things go.
Did training play a big part in controlling your fear?
Oh, yeah. Well, if you're not trained, you're not an army. I don't think you can do anything unless you have absolute confidence in the troops you command or the commander. That is the main thing. The troops in the Second World War, and I've been reading in history, the troops in the Second World War had more say in what's going on than they did in the First World War. I mean, the other ranks, they positioned things. I mean, commanders never pushed them in desperation unless that was really necessary. They didn't go in for massacre raids or anything like that, heroics. There were never, there was always thought went into the attack, not just jump up and run forward, you know, how we can get round it. That was what war was developing, pincer movements and that. It kind of withdrawn. If you hit a strong point, then you went out to the flanks and round and things like that. There's always another way round, isn't there?
How much confidence did you have in your officers?
Oh, in the 5 and 4, I had all the confidence in the world in them. I mean, they'd been in the army, well, Major Miller, he'd been with the 5 and 4 for ever since the outbreak of war. I mean, he knew his job, and you get to know officers by living with them. I mean, that was Neil. He was a captain, and I always used to call him Neil when he was in the tank. He always used to call me Tanner. But when he's outside and anybody about, he was always captain. But when you sleep with them, eat with them, you get like a family, don't you? It's like a family. I mean, you've got to get moved together, and you've got to, you know, do the chores, like you've got to cook the meals all together, like, so we cook them and have our meals together and everything like that, and everything's done, all the jobs are done together. I mean, you don't leave the driver to fill up the tank and the gunner to load his own ammunition. That is a job which everybody shares.
So did that build up a sense of comradeship?
Of course it did, yeah. Oh, mate. Oh, I mean, with these Scotch blokes, I don't know how many. Dave Kinnear was a Scotchman, our driver. I was English, Brellisford was English, but he got wounded, and I had another bloke from Suffolk. So I got on very well with all the Scotch people. They're a bit fiery, but you can't understand some of them. Are you Scotch? No Scots, huh? I mean, there's a bloke called Williams. I knew him for all the while I was in the 5th and 4th, more or less. I used to. I never could understand him, not properly. I knew what he was saying, but I've been on there when we was doing some schemes down in Suffolk. I remember with Major Shepherd. He was in charge in the Sergeant Major of A Squadron come up, and about something, he wanted something, he was, you know, I suppose he was with the echelon or something, wondered where the tank, I don't know what it was anyway, this, he kept on the air, and Major Shepherd said, "Can you understand him?" I said, "No." I said, "Say again." Whatever it was, what his station number was for Hood Charlie, or 12 or something like that. And he come up and he said again, he said, "I can't understand." I said, "I can't understand what he's talking about." So he said, "Leave it to me," he said, because we both had mics. He put his over to Sand and he said, "Say, put somebody on there who can speak English." Of course, he was an Englishman, hadn't he? Yeah.
But in action, did you mould together as a unit?
Oh, yeah. You got to, really. I mean, I don't know what it is. That's kind of, I think that's mainly, I mean, the 5th and 4th fought with, A Squadron fought with the British Second Army. B Squadron fought with the American Army. And C Squadron with the Canadian Army. I mean, they were in action all the while out there. The three squadrons, A, B and C, with the Americans, the British Second Army and the Canadian Army. And Ted was with the B Squadron, he was with the Americans, Ted Beckley. Of Because when we got all split up, we also got split up. The headquarters went, you see. We got split up, and we all finished up in different squadron.
I interrupted your narrative because you were telling me you'd just moved up towards near Antwerp after St. Leonard's.
Oh, St. Leonard's, yeah. We was going up towards... We'd gone up to a forest or somewhere, and there was a big forest. We was on the edge of a big forest, and I don't know how we got up there. I can't remember. I suppose the major had orders. I don't know. We was all there, the squadron tanks, and we got cut off. Because Jerry's cut the road behind us. We couldn't get no echelon up there. We stood up there, we was up there in this edge of this forest for 3 days, you know, and almost a 99% stand to, you know, formed leaguer and everything in the outskirts of it was all, we had to stand down with the bring guns and everything, you know, make a stand if we was attacked. Well, on the second day, I suppose they knew the position we was in. They had orders from, I don't know whether it was Corps Command or Div Command, what it was, that this forest, it was a big forest, and they had long straight drives through it. No, it's a man-made forest, you know, plant. And they asked the higher-up, whoever it was above the major, asked... ask him if we would do a recce, they wanted to know what was in the forest and what was up the other side. So, of course, our tank commander, he volunteered, Neil Rennie. I'm sure this is about right. They wouldn't send a crocodile because they'd have to have the trailer behind it and be awkward. So we went up there. They give us bands what we've got to report to and all that. We went up in this forest. There's so many driveways through it that we got lost. Anyway, we'd done the main thing. We'd been through past our points what we've got to reconnoitre, and there was Jerry landmines on some of these crossovers. He got out the tank and walked across his crossroads in the forest and looked and tried them, and he said, no, there's nothing there. So we went across, and, you know, we got across, and then all of a sudden we saw these tanks. And we stood and watched these tanks, and they were standing still. Anyway, we eventually crept down towards them, and that was our own lot. They were nearly going to fire on us because we got our guns pointing in the wrong direction. If you're going away from the enemy, your gun's over the back, and if you're going to him, it's over the front. And that is a normal thing. But they didn't fire on us anyway, so we done that. And the day after that, they got through again. I suppose that was just troops from north of Antwerp cutting through the common. They tried to hold it, didn't they, part of the time across there. But then we went on from there.
When you'd been there, were you isolated as a unit on your own, or did you have any infantry?
Oh, yeah, we had no transport or anything. We just had the tanks. I can't understand how we got there isolated like that. You see, they cut the road behind us and the echelon was there.
And you leaguered for the night. How did you leaguer?
Oh, you always form a leaguer, you know. A circle, like the old wagoners, more or less, or a square with all the guns pointing outwards. And then in between, you have your drivers dismount because you carry bang guns and all that. To cover up in between. Oh yes, it was a procedure you went through. I mean, that's the way it went. Then we went from there up to We'd done two or three little attacks, not much. We went up to Breda, that's in Holland. Then we went off to, oh, I don't know the name of that river now, where the Moerdijk Bridge goes over in Holland. It's not the, the Waal, is it? The Waal. Yeah, Lower Rhine, really, isn't it? The Waal. We went up there and there was a village just before the bridge. And we was going to make an attack because they reckoned the Jerrys had dug in this village and held it to protect the bridge. So we had none the morning. They put a Polish brigade with us. And when we was going up there, I mean, that was a pantomime. I'd never seen that. I don't know, the poor devils have been in action since D-Day, I should think, and they must have been shattered. You know what I mean? Really shattered. Because they were going along sweeping, because there was mines all over the place. And the infantry was going along, and these blokes were sweeping for mines on the side of the road. And one bloke with this detector, he went on, and a bloke coming behind spotted it. He missed the mine, and the bloke coming behind spotted it. They dig a bayonet in, and he called this bloke back. And I should never forget it. And the bloke just slung his earphones down as much to say, "You get on with it." I mean, you know. And he'd gone on over mine. Oh, dear.
Were these Polish troops?
Polish, yeah, Polish. Well, we went up and we was going to attack this village. And we was waiting, I suppose, till they got organised and got everything ready for this attack. And Jerry was shoving up some heavy stuff. I don't know what it was coming over. You know, fairly heavy shells, distance, I suppose they could see us, and they were shelling us, not very close. They're close enough, and of course the major went on to organise this attack on this place, and they decided to go in about 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock, I think it was. We'd start off, so we moved up to the start line. Nobody come. So it's 3 o'clock, British Army, right, straight off. Went straight off through this village. Never encountered a Jerry's at all. And we stayed in there. We stayed there about an hour. We went right through the village, and old Neil Rennie got out. He said, "I've had enough of this." He said, "I'm going to walk back and see where they are." Well, he went back to where the start line was, and they got there. I reckon the poor old boys were shattered, I don't know. Anyway, he left them back up there. We were sitting all up around this village, the flamethrowers, and we were sitting all round it. There weren't no Jerrys near it. And they come up there, and they were firing everything. You wouldn't believe it. They were firing everything. And I mean, that was worse than having the Jerrys firing at you. And then we went forward from there to the Moerdijk Bridge. And we didn't go on the road to the Moerdijk Bridge. We cut down a little lane, but there's quite a distance from the road. There was a kind of field going down to the floodplain of the Waal. And this little narrow lane, of course, we got the flamethrowers up there, and they can't turn round with this blinking trailers on behind. We got up there, and we was behind them. I think there was only four tanks up there, and we was going to kind of get round and on the plain. There was no firing or opposition, and all of a sudden there was this terrific bang, and up went the Moerdijk Bridge, the centre bits of the Moerdijk Bridge. So I saw it going up in the air, you know, thought it was fantastic. So Neil Rennie comes up to the major and he said, well, you can't do no more there. If they've blown the bridge, that's it. He said, you just have to return to us. As we was reversing up this narrow lane, you know, it was a bit covered, suddenly I see the old wireless aerial going down like a crack, a scream. There was an armour-piercing shell flying out. That was the poles behind us opened up on us with 17 pounders. They missed us. Yeah, they opened up on us with 17 pounds.
So what was your opinion of serving? What was your opinion of serving with these poles?
Well, that soured the whole thing. That did that. I think Major Walker went up and said in future he'd have to have written orders before he'd go into action with them. I don't know how true it was, but I expect that was true because that came from a second in command. He said in future I must have written orders. Well, you send tanks in on their own. A Panzerfaust can create hell with the determined bloke behind. Nothing's more lethal than a Panzerfaust well camouflaged. Yeah, they can put you out of action quite easy.
What were the main threats to tanks at that time besides the Panzerfaust?
88. When you used to hear, there's an 88 sound position.
Does it have a distinctive sound?
It's a scream. You see, anti-tank shells, our anti-tank shells, they've got a note of their own when they go through the air. They don't stop. The shell loops, doesn't it? A squeeze shot, anti-tank round, goes more or less straight. And you see the whoosh, and that the aerials, the old aerials we used to have on, when they come near, they used to bend down like that.
Yeah. What was the threat from mines like?
Never come across too many. We was trained to deal with mines. Never had mine detectors, but if ever we hit a mine, when we bailed out, say that it'd normally blow the track or something off. When you bailed out, you've got to take a bayonet or the prodder for the gun and gun cleaning thing out and used to prod sideways. I knew how to clear mines. Be carefully. You prod into the side and find out where it is. And then you've got to be careful there ain't no booby trap on it. Clearing it gently, and if that's just an ordinary teller mine, you could lift an anti-tank mine, you could lift it up and put it on the side, leave it for somebody else, the engineers and that.
What type of damage would a mine do?
Well, certainly blow your tracks or one track off or something like that, you know, just certainly damage some of the crew. The underbelly of a tank is not all that thick, you see. The underbelly and the top, the flat top, you know, with the engine covers and that, is not all that thick. That's a weak point in between the sides and the front. The front is more armoured than the rest of it, really. And the turret's well armoured.
So what happened next after you'd supported these poles in the attack?
Well, we had to come back, and we come back to Breda again. We had to go back to Breda. Oh, of course, we couldn't go no further. We'd gone up to the wall, and they'd blown the bridge up there. I suppose they knew the bridge was still standing. I don't know whether it was a railway bridge or a road bridge. Big long bridge. We come back to Breda, and we'd like it up in a hero conserving. And that's where I saw some things there. They, the Dutch company, and they'd specialised in frozen foods. Now you can believe this, wouldn't you? And they got to these cardboard boxes of soup, all frozen for the German army. And apparently they froze this stuff in boxes and then transported it in insulated trains and that, and fed the Jerry troops on it. That's the first time I'd seen any... Of course, refrigerators weren't, you know, not like they are today, but we had... And I'll tell you what they had, they'd froze some of these strawberries, and the people that worked in them, of course, they give us these strawberries, the Dutch people couldn't give us enough, you know. And we spent a couple of days there, and then we went, this was getting near the winter now, the winter.
This October, November time?
Yeah, oh, it's just getting November time, yeah. We pulled out and we were sent to a place just short of Eindhoven.